Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
The first time I witnessed mindfulness meditation was in a cowshed in West Clare. I'd heard of the practice of being in the moment, and I'd even read some of the teachings of Jon Kabat-Zinn and Thich Nhat Hanh, but still I struggled with the concept. Then, one very wet evening by the estuary, where the Atlantic Ocean and the Shannon and Fergus rivers begin to socialise, the idea of being in the moment was explained. Outside the cowshed, I squelched and dripped, moving like a robot in restricting rain gear, trying to make myself useful, as humans sometimes need to do, even in the most ludicrous conditions. Inside the shed stood four donkeys, gazing softly, as mindfulness practice would suggest, out the door. Because they weren't looking at me, I joined them in the shed. My need not so much to be present as to be in their presence. The donkeys ignored my soaking wet intrusion, deep in the stillness of their meditation. I stood amongst them seeking attention. When none was offered, I lay an arm over the animal to either side of me. The rise and fall of their bodies was grace-filled, gentle. They looked out at the teeming rain as it cross-stitched into the estuary waters, a basket of great thread above, below, and beyond. The rhythm of the rain on the corrugated roof was ornamented by the gush from the gullies and the eaves. If they saw what I saw, they didn't react, but seemed to accept each moment, each raindrop, without judgment, watching it dissolve as the coming moment replaced it. Elvis, the tall grey jack donkey, was on my right. Because of his wicked sense of humour, I was surprised by his ability to stay so still for so long. His partner, Priscilla, was on my other side. Her mindfulness practice was no surprise, as she always seemed serene. Their two daughters, Star and Makushla, practiced as I imagined veterans would. Ease and containment seemed to emanate from their breaths. As the five of us stood together, I began to understand the suggestion of being in the moment. Priscilla was 4 years old when I went to Roscommon to collect her. Down another small road, a man asked me what I had in the horse box. When he heard what my cargo was, he pleaded with me to take a young jack donkey that was a scourge to him, that it would be an ease to him. I thought it would be an ease to the grey gangly animal too, as he was spancelled with rope and a block of timber. When I brought the two of them home, a neighbour asked me what was Elvis, stating that if he was a jack, then all his apparel hadn't arrived from Roscommon. In time, his package arrived. And when he found his voice, he and Priscilla set about the language of the heart. Star was their firstborn, meeting the world from a field of buttercups as summer blazed the estuary in light taken from an Aegean ideal. 2 years later, Makushla gave the world her delicate presence. Both foals were brown like their mother, with none of the garishness of their Jack the Lad father. The day could be timed by their movements. They spent each night and early morning in the big meadow and gradually, lazily moved through the eastern ban, the orchard field, to Gurna Hill, where they stayed until nightfall. They were wonderful watchdogs, alert to each and every paw and footfall in their realm. Four sets of ears would point to a field corner, tracing a fox or evening badger. They would bray when the gate latch clicked. They would delight in human visitors, the three females attracted to brightly coloured clothes and carrots, Elvis trying to bite a hand or leg or pushing his weight against the fragile human. After their initial lesson in mindfulness practice, I sought their company for subsequent teachings. They taught me the importance of noticing the changes in the day and season, of seeking shelter or shade, and that gaining their trust for a human is something hard won but easily lost. They had their individual moments of practice each day, but I never found them in collective meditation as intense as that wonderful wet evening. Since that day, Elvis, sadly, has left the building. While Mukushla followed her father's spirit and is now buried on Gurna Hill, Priscilla had one more son, Flop, while Star had her own son, Flip. Today, Priscilla, Star, Flip and Flop course the same route each day and night. They remain watchful for each movement and change, noticing, not judging, accepting, not reacting, except when humans impose change that usually is not necessary. They continue to teach if the lesson is sought, and continue doing with ease what can be so difficult to do. Breathing in, breathing out. Breathing in, breathing out.
Thank you. I have, over the years, spent many hours of my life standing in front of my wardrobe, in my dressing gown, moaning, most usually to my husband, that I have nothing to wear. This usually occurs when we are going out. Not to somewhere fancy, mind you, because then I definitely wouldn't have something to wear, and that fact would be of no surprise to anyone, and so I'd have planned accordingly and bought something. But no, this moaning is reserved for when we're just going out, maybe to the pub or for a meal with friends. In desperation, I stare into the abyss that is my wardrobe and loudly lament. My husband always looks from me to the wardrobe full of clothes with a huge thought bubble emanating from his head, which clearly reads, "Are you mad, woman?" But having been married to me forever, he rarely articulates this thought, even though I'm sure he knows that I can see it. And so he will mutter something fairly innocuous that he thinks won't make me explode. Well, a few weeks into this new pandemic world, I can categorically state that I now truly have nothing to wear. And this time, I'm not going anywhere. But I don't have a wardrobe for this new life. How could I? This new life came out of nowhere. We weren't given time to adequately prepare. All right, we knew this virus was coming, but nowhere did I see or hear a mention of the general public needing special clothes in order to cope with this enforced springtime hibernation. No, no warning, nothing at all. And yes, I know my wardrobe malfunction is emphatically not a real problem in the greater scheme of things. But giving our attention to the small practicalities of life is how many of us are getting through this strange time. And on that, let me be clear about two things. Firstly, I am not what my dear mother would call a fashion plate. No, I am a middle-aged woman. And like most middle-aged women, actually no, like most women, I suspect, I like to be well turned out, but I like to be comfortable. And just now, I can't find where that comfort is. Okay, so I know I could stay in my PJs all day, but that's not very hygienic, especially now. Also, I'm not a slob. So PJs, they're not the answer. We may not be going out much, but we have to venture out for a walk every day. And even under the latest restrictions, we occasionally need to visit a shop or the chemist. Leggings and a sweatshirt are appropriate for the walking. But seriously, how many people over 45 do you know who look good in lycra, even when coupled with a huge sweatshirt? I don't feel at my best in public with all my lumps and bumps on show, when I am not obviously engaged in an activity aimed at reducing those lumpy bits. Jeans are my usual casual attire, but you can't lounge on the sofa in jeans. And yes, of course my jeans are stretchy, but they still aren't that comfortable when one is reclined horizontally. What we need, and need urgently, is a range of good quality but very cheap loungewear that, to use fashion parlance, could take us from sofa to home office to the supermarket and back, allowing us to feel comfortable and at our best in a relaxed and informal way. And just as that realisation set in, what happened? The non-essential shops had to close, including the very places where we might actually have had some hope of finding such garments at prices we could afford. So it looks like for the coming weeks, or even months, I am reduced to changing my clothes twice or maybe three times a day as I attempt not to completely let myself go. But I worry I'm already on that slippery slope. My poor nails are wearing shellac that is well over a month old and has started to crack and chip. I'm no fashionista, but I've always been allergic to the sight of chipped nail varnish. And don't get me started on my hair. Without the miraculous ministrations of my local hair salon, the grey is appearing at an alarming rate. Hairdressers have instructed us not to even consider doing a desperation box colour ourselves, as the damage we inflict on our barnets might take years to sort out. Use one of those root sprays, they advise. Which is a great idea, except root sprays are now as rare as flour and liquid soap in the supermarkets. So I am well on my way to full-on bag lady in my lycra leggings, chipped nails and greying hair. If you see me on my daily regulation excursion close to my home, you can feel free to ignore me. Although I'm fairly confident, looking how I do at present, it's highly unlikely you'll recognise me.
When I wake up in the morning light, I pull on my jeans and I feel all right. I pull my blue jeans on, I pull my old blue jeans on.
I had been to see The Clash and was waiting for a southbound tube train when Susan made her move. "I've been watching you," she said. "You were at the gig, weren't you?" "Yes," I replied, taking in her back-combed hair and a T-shirt that read, "What are you looking at?" "What did you think of them?" "I don't think of them at all," she replied with a wonky, lopsided smile. "And what do you do when you're not chatting up girls on a train?" "I'm not chatting you up," I said, a hint of indignation in my voice, "and we're not yet on a train." "Ooh," she was laughing now. "Observant little fellow, aren't we? But you haven't answered my question." "I work in a cinema," I replied truthfully. "No," she was shaking her head. "I don't see you there. I don't see you in a cinema at all." It had started to occur to me that this might be the start of a conversation that would end with me penniless and without shoes, locked in the wardrobe of a backpacker's hostel. But I couldn't resist. "So where do you see me?" I asked. "I see you having breakfast with me tomorrow morning," she said. "There's a cafe next to Warren Street Station. Don't be later than 9. And she was gone. So the next day, because I had been brought up to do as I was told, I went to the cafe and was eating toast when she arrived. "What do you know about beat poetry?" she asked on her way to the counter. "Not much," I said. "You mean like Allen Ginsberg?" "That's it." She sat across the table from me and stirred too much sugar into her tea. "But it needs updating, and it can't be American." My mind immediately turned to the riches that ticket tearing had recently brought me. "Do people make a living out of poetry?" I asked. "No, they don't," Susan said, "and I'll tell you why. Because the modern poet lacks something his historical forebears took for granted." It was still 8:45 in the morning. Was I really having a conversation that involved historical forebears already? I looked at Susan blankly. "Patrons," she said. "They all had patrons." "But isn't that a bit old-fashioned?" "If you regard a situation whereby the rich and the fortunate support the talented and poor as old-fashioned, then yes, I suppose it is. But I would be very disappointed and would have to assume that our professional relationship was at an end." I let her words hang in the air for a moment before saying, "We don't have a professional relationship, do we? We're meeting over breakfast, aren't we? I can't think of anything more professional than that." I had by this time finished my toast and was wondering whether I should leave when Susan went on. "So the question is, where is your patron? And the answer," she pushed a scrap of paper across the table, "is here." Before I could look at the scrap properly, she smoothed it flat and read out its message. 17 Cheyne Walk, Chelsea. "Is that where you live?" I asked. "No." She looked at me with something resembling pity. "This is the address of John Paul Getty." "What?" "According to the Sunday Times, Mr. Getty is the richest man in the world." She looked me hard in the eye and, for the first time since we'd met, lowered the tone of her voice. "If you want to be rich, you need to go where the money is." And so it was that later that evening I stood beside Susan on the front step of 17 Cheyne Walk and pressed its doorbell as confidently as I could. Somewhere, far down a hallway we both imagined was lined with marble and champagne, we heard a bell softly ringing. And then there was a deep and long-lasting silence. And when it ended, I tried the bell again, and then the silence returned. After about 20 minutes, we decided that either Mr. Getty was out, or that perhaps he was enjoying an early night, and eager not to disturb him further, we retraced our steps towards the gate. We were just stepping back onto the street when the door opened, and a small man, wearing a suit and a pair of bedroom slippers, scowled towards us from the hallway. "What do you want?" he asked. "Excuse me," Susan called back at him. "Are you John Paul Getty?" "I wish I was," the man said. "What do you want him for?" "My friend here," and Susan pointed at me, "is a beat poet. He is, however, eager not to starve, and I thought that Mr. Getty might like to help." "I don't know how Mr. Getty got so rich," the man told us, "but I bet it wasn't by giving money to poets." "We don't want all his money," Susan said, "just a percentage, an amount he'd hardly miss." "You're talking about a stipend," the man continued. "Exactly." For the first time, he turned his gaze firmly towards me. "You're very quiet for a poet," he started. "Are you any good?" For some reason, I suddenly thought that I might be, and filled with unfounded confidence, answered, "Yes, I'm very good." He asked whether I could name a poem or two that I'd written, and from somewhere I called out, "Oxford Circus Breakdown." "Hmm." He seemed quite impressed. I was on a roll now and shouted, "I knew a girl called Paris. That's the one I'm working on at the moment." He nodded again, and, as if suddenly remembering something he'd meant to do earlier, reached into his inside pocket and took out a wallet. "Here's £5, he said. "Buy yourselves a fish supper and get off my property." "Do you think that was him?" I asked, as we sat on a wall eating. "Well, he did give us money, didn't he?" Susan replied. "Yes," I said, "but not very much. And if it was John Paul Getty, then he talked about himself in the third person." "A lot of successful people do that," said Susan, before adding, "Susan's thinking of doing it too." "Yes," I replied. "I bet she is."
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want.
Johann Sebastian Bach composed his wonderful and complex oratorio, the St. Matthew Passion, in 1727 for solo voices, two choirs, and an orchestra. It probably had its first performance in the city of Leipzig, in the St. Thomas Church, where Bach was resident organist and composer, on Good Friday of that year. It's a powerful work that takes the text of the Good Friday Passion of the Christ and gives it magnificent scope and a musical interpretation that remains dramatic, but is almost always performed in situ, in a church gallery or on a stage, as a choral and orchestral piece. We were lucky enough to attend a very rare and moving presentation of the St. Matthew Passion in Thomaskirche in Leipzig, a performance that was acted out by singers, soloists and orchestra moving about the great church in a highly dramatic performance. The usual audience or congregation for the Passion performance is passive, simply listening. The performance we attended was acted out and was richly different. And this is how I remember our experience that evening. There is a storm tonight in Thomaskirche. Judas scuttles about, fists reaching like claws. He embraces the quiet Lord and is embraced. The mobs, in chorus, agitated, rush like waves towards the shore and out again. I am back of the church in a dark angle, scarce seeing. My neck hurts, arthritis, aging. I resist heartily the music, but my eyes are dry. I have touched on grief before, perhaps too often. Soprano, bass, alto, tenor. So many ocean breakers hasten busily around amongst us, holding high the poster of this wanted man. Do you know him? Do you recognize this man. Surely you are one of his disciples. And what has he done, this man? He has been crying in the streets, on the lake shores, urging the needs of the poor and oppressed, asking the questions we do not want to hear. So let there be noise and chorus. The sea is washing over us. But we who stand or sit do not drown. It is Bach Prospero, and we are ticket holders. Under my feet, shifting sands. To my left, an elegant granite column rises into the darkness of the roof. Here, on the hill, the hero, Christ, is on the rood. The music now is ended. Once more are we hopeful for calmer seas, auspicious gales. We have risen out of the wreck and know we are again forgiven. We are such stuff as flotsam, and we are blessed to be cast up safe tonight on this city's shore. But tell me, as we listened, were not our hearts on fire within us?
People say we do death well in Ireland. When my husband's father died suddenly 5 years ago, the local community rallied around his family. His body was laid out in the front room. Friends brought casseroles. People drove from all over the country for the funeral. Memories were shared. Tears were shed. This is not an unusual story. In fact, it describes every death in Ireland I've ever experienced. We do death well, not because we grasp on to archaic traditions of wailing women and waked corpses, but because even now, in the 21st century, it is a ritual. We come together for the removal. We shake hands. We hug the members of the family we know well. We offer words of comfort, however shyly or awkwardly, to the ones we don't. We walk the coffin to the graveyard. We drink. We sing. We remember. My father died last week. After 13 long years, he succumbed to a disease that stripped him of his identity, of his wit, of his recognition, and eventually of his ability to live. Grief is something different to everyone, but with Alzheimer's, it happens slowly and constantly. I remember the beginning, when my father had enough awareness to watch those he loved treat him differently. He was now a patient, not a peer. I remember the day I asked him to sign a birthday card for my mother, and he sat for 10 minutes staring at the pen, wondering at its function. That was the middle. And then there was the end, when life delivered him back to his earliest state, a 70-year-old man who needed the care of a newborn, just as vulnerable, just as reliant, just as devoid of understanding. My family has lived with this chronic grief for my entire adult life. It has had an impact on the smallest aspects of our daily living and on our broadest life choices. I thought when the time eventually came, we would finally be allowed to share in it with others. We would come together with people we know and some we don't, in that act of ritual we Irish do so well. A funeral. Something to put a full stop at the end of this drawn-out story. But these are not usual times. We are living through a moment in which no one will have the collective grief or the funerals they deserve. Neither the dead nor the living. Families across the world will have to carry their loss within themselves. This virus is reducing lives to numbers, and we are in danger of doing the same ourselves. When every day brings more deaths, the numbers climb to a point that seems incomprehensible, and it is hard to feel like anything is really real. So let me tell you that it is. We must not get complacent about life. For anyone losing a loved one at the moment, whether it was a long life lived well or a short life ended abruptly, these strange times do not make their departure from this world any less heartbreaking. It is a cruel irony that my father, a man who was denied the act of remembering in life, was not memorialized in a way wanted or needed in death. It is something my family will live with, and indeed share with others, as people continue to die in great numbers over the coming months. In many ways, I think my dad would be glad about the way things ended, seeing a golden opportunity to slip out the back door without anyone noticing. A very Irish way to leave the party. Behind masks, behind doors, behind windows, I will remember and celebrate him. I know others will too. I hope one day we will do so together.
Leave your message after the tone, and when you've finished, press hash or just hang up.
Hello. I'm just getting back again with a few thoughts. I was saying that I have so much time on my hands, I should be writing. But I can't. The words aren't coming. And all my friends are saying the same thing. And I'm not sure why. I've seen so many poems and posts shared, and they're beautiful. And I just think, I'm just not that certain. I don't have the wisdom to share. And maybe I should. I'm slipping into the elderly, wise bracket. Some groups are calling me elderly already, and I'm just not ready for that yet. But I went outside today for a walk. There was sunshine, and it was hitting the River Lennon. And I took a deep breath. And then I smiled. When we were kids and we'd go out in Donegal, Mum would always say, "Ah, look, take a deep breath." So I thought, yes, Mum, I'm taking a deep breath. And just right then, a black rabbit appeared in the bushes. For some reason, we have black wild rabbits that appear every year. This is the first. Out from hibernation, back for the summer. And I thought, yes, I'll take that.
On this morning's programme, we heard Mindfulness by Maurice Crowe, I Have Nothing to Wear by Barbara Scully, Susan Calling by Chris McCallum, The St. Matthew Passion by John F. Dean, A Hard Time to Die in Memory of Michael Boland by Mary Jane Boland, and Isolation Voicemail by Denise Blake. The music was Anuman by Django Reinhardt and Coleman Hawkins, played by Boris Hunka on piano and Diane Daly on violin. And both that and the script from Maurice Crowe that preceded it were recorded at Sunday Miscellany's recent live event at Ennis Book Club Festival. Jeans On by David Dundas. Money by the Flying Lizards. Erbarme dich, mein Gott, from Bach's St. Matthew's Passion, sung by Stephanie Blythe with the Ensemble d'Orchestral de Paris, conducted by John Nelson. An Chulainn, the Chulainn, played on piano by Sean O'Riordan. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.